Welcome to the Talk About AI podcast, a podcast about artificial intelligence where we go beyond the buzzwords. In this episode, the invited guest is Sala Fanzén. She is the chief data scientist at one of the biggest banks in the Nordic countries, SEB, with around 15,000 employees. What is SEB actually doing within the area of AI? Why is SEB not yet using AI for automated credit decisions? These and many other topics will be discussed in the episode. For more information about the podcast, please visit the website talkaboutai.com. My name is Patrick Liu Tran, and I'm the host of this podcast. Once again, welcome to the Talk About AI podcast. I am happy to introduce Sala Fanzén as the guest of this Talk About AI episode. She is the chief data scientist at the bank SEB. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
You have an impressive background, including academic research. You have been a portfolio manager and you have been the head of index and solutions here at SEB. Could you tell us more about your background and how you ended up as the chief data scientist?
Sure. I've always been sort of passionate about mathematics ever since I was a kid. And I think that's kind of what brought me to finance in the end after like 12 years of pure mathematics. And I think the good thing about working in like a large organization like SEB is that you get the opportunity to do many different things. And I've always sort of been driven by choosing work that I find fun. So fun is really what I'm driven by.
You have done a PhD within mathematics.
Yeah, in theoretical mathematics. So it's like several complex variables, loads of differential geometry, loads of kind of differential topology as well to be able to cut up surfaces in several complex dimensions. It has no applications whatsoever in finance.
So how did you go from that to finance?
Yeah, I mean, when I finished my PhD, I was kind of thinking about what I wanted to do. And I decided that I'd give mathematics sort of research a chance. So I did a postdoc first in Oslo and then in Sundsvall. And then I kind of figured out that maybe I really wanted to do something where the sort of career path was less clear. So, I mean, if you do theoretical mathematics, you do research, you become a professor, hopefully at some stage you have your own research group, but that's kind of it. And I thought, like, finance has always kind of fascinated me. And at the time when I did my PhD, we had all these financial crises and things like that. And I thought, like, maybe a mathematician could actually help out there a little bit to try to have better pricing algorithms, for instance. I mean, one of the big problems with the whole financial crisis in the 2000s was the fact that the pricing was not right. So people were pricing things badly, which created this complete chaos. And I mean, for me, mathematics is kind of cool because it's either right or it's wrong and you can logically prove your thesis. So kind of finding different applications of mathematics in finance is really, really fun. And now, of course, I get to really focus on that.
So you first worked several years within fund management and focusing on risk and different aspects of that. How did you transition from that into the current role as the chief data scientist?
Yeah, so I did risk analysis for the fund company for like a year and a half. And then I was portfolio manager for several years. And then I headed the index and solutions team for quite a large part of that time. And that's very mathematical. So it's sort of finding optimal ways of investing without driving cost, but being able to still follow the market index as close as possible. And then after that, I was a risk manager in private banking, which was super fun because those people that work there, they're the best. It's so much fun. They're like really, really nice and it's such a nice work environment. And after that, I was asked to be the counterparty risk head. So then I had a team of quants doing sort of counterparty risk. But then I was already kind of passionate about introducing machine learning to the bank. So my manager and I started a data science community for risk. And that was quite sort of fun to start to explore that terrain from a sort of a risk management viewpoint. And then at some stage, somebody heard about me and asked me if I wanted to be the chief data scientist. And I thought, oh, my God, that's so cool. Yes.
I remember it was in 2017, right?
Yeah.
And I remember, because I interact with a lot of top management teams of big organizations here in Sweden, and that was one of the first big companies to appoint such a role.
Wow, yeah, I didn't know that actually.
Yeah, so a lot of people kind of looked at SEB and tried to figure out, should we also do this? But who did you get the question from?
So it was from Nicola Mock, who was then the head of information strategy and architecture, and Rasmus Järborg, who was our chief strategy officer at the time.
So it really came from the top?
Yeah, yeah.
Has your work here been initiated and supported a lot from the top management team?
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the success factors of, a humble brag. I guess one of the sort of good parts about my position and the work environment where I work is that the buy-in for really using machine learning and using sort of AI applications in finance, it comes from the board. So, I mean, our chairman is super impressive when it comes to knowledge and skills about applications of AI in Swedish industry. And our CEO is also like really, really interested and knowledgeable about this. So then it's much easier for us to have that dialogue.
That's really cool to hear. And for the people who don't know, could you just explain what is SEB?
So SEB is, we like to say that we're the number one Nordic corporate bank. We've been around since 1856, so quite a long time. I would say that we like sort of people with high ambitions and kind of an entrepreneur mindset. So I mean, we have kind of most of the bank offering that you could imagine. We have a life company, we have an investment management company, we have large corporates, financial institutions, corporates, private customers, private banking, all of the different kinds of aspects of banking that you need in order to sort of cater for the clients that we have. But I would say that we mainly focus on our Nordic customers, and then we follow them out into the world. So if they have needs for banking in other countries, then we try to sort of cater for that as well.
SEB is actually my first employer ever. It has been one of the best jobs I've ever had. Aww. So shout out to my former manager if he's listening. And before we dig into the details, I usually ask, how do you define artificial intelligence?
Ah, yes. I mean, the difficulty about defining artificial intelligence is that you have to define intelligence, and that's not done, because intelligence can have so many different aspects. And then if you start to try to define artificial intelligence without defining intelligence, it's going to be a problem. But I think in the European Union, we're kind of fortunate because we have the high-level expert group that does sort of thinks very deeply about the sort of implementation of AI in the European Union. And they also have a definition, which is that it should be sort of an intelligent system that has some degree of autonomy and some degree of kind of thinking.
Yeah. And you mentioned machine learning earlier on.
Yeah.
How do you put machine learning in relation to AI?
Yeah, so I guess this is where it shows that I'm a researcher. For me, machine learning is like the foundation. Artificial intelligence won't exist without machine learning. And then when it comes to more interfaces or services, that's where you can start to introduce the more artificial intelligence part. So machine learning is like the mathematics, the algorithms, the computing power, all of that. And then the artificial intelligence is the sort of application that you choose to use the machine learning algorithms for.
Cool. That's a cool distinction. And what do you think are some of the biggest misconceptions when it comes to AI nowadays?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think my feeling is kind of that since AI is kind of hyped still, I think a lot of people, if they want to talk about AI, they choose the fear way because that's kind of the thing that will give you attention. But for me, AI is kind of it's a tool, and you can choose to use it for different reasons. And if you choose to use it for good reasons, then that's what we should be doing.
So you basically think that people are too afraid of AI?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are afraid of AI because they don't potentially understand what it is. They read newspapers and they get worried, which is fine. And that's a true feeling that we need to acknowledge. And I mean, one of the good things about being a European country, a Nordic country, is that we have this culture of education anyway. And now we have the elements of AI.com where you can go and you can learn sort of the basics of AI. What is AI and what is not AI? And I mean, it's interesting with these sort of robot killers and stuff. So I'm fortunate to work quite closely with KTH. So I speak to the true robot researchers who do real robotics perception and learning. And I'm not worried. yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying. If you go to some of the research labs, you see that they're struggling to kind of teach robots to cut bread.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's sort of the state of the art. And these are like some of the best researchers in the world. I mean, because AI has so many different ways of existing. When it's a physical robot, that's an extremely difficult problem. And just moving from like the simulated environment to the physical environment creates so much more complexity. And just creating a sort of a good simulated environment is super difficult. So it comes down to the details and the technical details. Yeah. So I would say, I mean, what I would expect is that in like the coming 5-10 years, the true implementations of AI will be on digital interfaces. So not physical robots, but more digital robots. Yeah.
Yeah. So you kind of don't need to worry about the hardware integration parts.
No, but I think what we need to really consider and do carefully is sort of the ethical implementation of AI, the data privacy. GDPR is such a gift from above for us and our citizens in the EU, because it means that the companies are at least slightly limited from doing bad things. And it gives us the opportunity to really be as transparent as we can about what we're doing. Of course, we're a bank, so I mean, as a bank, the client privacy has always been core to us.
I think that a common perception of the GDPR is that it kind of inhibits a lot of innovations within the AI area, since you do not really know what you can and cannot do with data, and the usage of data is a lot more limited.
Yeah.
How do you see it as a blessing from above?
I mean, I can give a more nuanced answer than just a blessing from above. I think one of the things that can sort of make or break the success of AI is if researchers or companies start to use AI for bad. And GDPR is kind of step one to be able to hinder that. Because, I mean, even if everybody has the best intentions, you don't know what's going to happen. Then when it comes to sort of newer companies or innovation in AI, I agree. In many cases, we will probably end up doing things slower in the European Union. But I would rather that we do things slower and right than that we do things fast and end up doing bad things. So I'm more than willing to let it take a little bit more time if the time that it takes is spent on considering ethical issues, considering privacy, considering all of those perspectives that are super, super, super important.
How has GDPR affected your work here?
Yeah, I mean, so GDPR hasn't really affected us that much. In Sweden, we have the PUL, which is a kind of a data privacy law since before. So I would say that the impact hasn't been that big. We're already used to privacy and to think about the integrity of our clients.
PUL that you refer to is in Swedish personuppgiftslagen,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's a Swedish regulation.
Yeah.
Another interesting aspect that I've heard from people in industry related to GDPR is the fact that, I mean, before GDPR, people had very little knowledge about what data they actually collected and stored and why. And the GDPR, in a sense, forced them to look through everything to, yeah, just understand why are we collecting this data and what do we actually store. Was it the same here?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, we checked that we knew that there were no unknown unknowns. I mean, I was at MIT this summer for the 13th MIT CDOIQ conference. It's a really good name. Mm-hmm. But it was a bunch of CDOs, and it was really interesting because they have an American perspective. So there was only four of us from more international companies or from outside the U.S. And it was so sort of illustrative that the like I would ask questions about data privacy. I would ask questions about how they're handling that in other companies. And they some of them just looked at me like I was a crazy person. They said, no, but we just use the data. And I said, but yeah, but what about the integrity of your clients? And it was like a question that they hadn't really considered yet. And I think that's going to come to them as well. I hope so.
And the CDO in this case.
It's the chief data officer. The D can stand for a lot of things. Yeah, it's the So chief data officer can mean either that you take care of data governance and data management, or it can be data governance, data management, and analytics. One of the major topics of the conference was what do we do? What does a CDO do? Yeah.
I think that's a really cool transition because historically CDO has meant chief digital officer, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And now it's chief data officer.
Yeah, at least for me.
Yeah, I think we're going towards that direction since companies now are realizing the value of good data.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. And I mean, one of the things that we've talked about in the AI agenda for Sweden as well is digitization is kind of the step one. If you don't do digitization, you cannot do AI. You have to have data. And the way to get data is to be digital. And then, of course, once you have data, you need to know what data it is. You need to know the quality. You need to do the management. You need to do everything that's so important in order to be able to feel trust in the data that you want to use. And after that, you can do sort of more AI applications. And you don't necessarily have to govern all of your data. It's more like identifying the core, what is like the core of your business and doing the hard work there.
So you're basically saying between the lines that AI work takes time. You need to take it step by step.
Yeah.
I think that's many times an eye-opener to top management people in big organizations who kind of sometimes think that if they just invest enough money into AI, it will be up and running.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, investing in the right things can definitely enable AI, investing in the people, investing in the employees, allowing them the time to do all the hard work with the data can really sort of release a lot of business value. But I think the tendency historically, not at SCB, but when I look at other companies and when I look at how the sort of industry is working, they tend to buy the cool stuff, but they don't do the housekeeping. And then it's kind of like, it won't give you the full value. And it takes patience and it takes skilled people and it takes a lot of, you find a lot of fun stuff when you do that. So yeah, it takes a lot of humor.
What would be the cool stuff and what would be housekeeping? Can you give some examples of that?
Yeah. So, I mean, housekeeping would be finding good ways to join tables. It's very, very concrete.
Join different data sets.
Yeah, joining different data sets, understanding if you're allowed to, understanding what the implications are for client integrity, assessing the data quality, assessing that models don't contradict each other that you want to build, and understanding if they do contradict each other, understanding why.
And the cool stuff.
And the cool stuff is, of course, the applications where you get like a ping that you should contact a client and you contact them and they're super happy. That's the super cool stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As the chief data scientist at a big bank, what are you actually doing?
I get that question a lot. One of the things that I really focus on is speaking to people internally to understand where their pain points are or look into their business plan together with them and give them advice on what kind of tooling they might need in order to use AI in their business. And that's definitely kind of one of the core things that I enjoy doing and where I can see that we add value as a team. So my work description is that I should inspire the bank to be more data-driven. I like this. It's so sort of, it can be anything. But I've sort of defined it for myself as really sort of educating the business when it's needed. helping the business when it's needed and supporting them on their kind of journey to become data-driven. Then I also go to quite a lot of conferences, both for myself to get more inspiration, to hear about what other people are thinking about, what kind of applications people are doing, discussing with my peers, because we have a lot of common questions that we need to figure out somehow. And it's nice to have good contact with other people that are doing the same thing, because one is much less smart than many.
Yeah.
And then I have my star team. So there's 9 data scientists and 2 data visualization experts. So I try to see to it that they are still having fun at work and that they're learning new things and that they get to shine when they do cool stuff. Yeah.
So how is your function that you're leading structured within the organization?
So there's 11 of us in my team. So there's 9 data scientists and 2 data visualization experts, and we work across the whole bank. So depending on where the needs are the largest, depending on how the business has prioritized the things that they want us to do, we connect together with the business people and we start to work together. So typically it starts with data exploration, discussing what it is they're trying to find, trying to sort of quantify the questions that they have so that we can use the data to glean insights. And then it's all about sort of working very close. Because for me, it's really, really important that everything we do is integrated into the business. Because we, of course, want people to use what we're doing. And the only way that I can see for us to do that is to build together. Because just as having worked in the bank in other functions, I would never use a tool that I didn't understand. And the best way to understand is to do together.
And how many people work at the bank in total?
There's about 15,000 of us.
And you're 11 people in your team?
Yes.
Do you think that you're well staffed?
There's 15,000 of us as employees. About a year ago, we started something that we call the data science community. And that's kind of it's an open community for anybody working in the bank who's interested in machine learning. So we meet once a month. We have researchers come and talk to us about like the latest research things. If people have built something cool, they can come and demo it. They can come to get feedback on whatever they've done. If they got stuck in some parameter stuff, that's kind of the perfect venue to come to. And we've grown to about 120, 130 people right now. So I think that's really nice because the model that we're trying to go for is to have the kind of special forces team, which is my team. And then when we identify areas where the business value in the data is huge, then we collaborate when it's needed. If they already have data scientists, we try to support them if they get stuck somewhere. Otherwise, we just let them be. But if they don't have data scientists, then we collaborate for a while. And then if there is enough business value, then we're more than willing to move data scientists out into the organization to create like it's called a federated model where you have a small sort of group, a common team, and then you have teams spread out in the organization. And since we're trying to create that, I wanted to do the data science community as well, because I don't want people to be left alone in sort of business teams. I want data scientists to know other data scientists because that's what they need as well. They need to connect with other people that have common interests and to sort of geek out about algorithms and the latest research. Yeah.
So basically, the data scientists that you lead are not the only data scientists in SCB.
Exactly.
How many are there in total, roughly?
Yeah, that's a good question. We have 120 people in the community.
And it's for internal people only.
Yeah. Right now it's only for internal. Yeah, I don't know how many. I'm not going to give you a number.
No, but more than 100.
Yeah, I would say so.
And is it only data scientists in this community?
In the data science community, yes, I think so, because we tend to get really technical in the community meetings. And I think that's important as well, because we need some place where we can be very technical. And then we can have other kinds of meetings and inspiration stuff where we can demo fun things. And that's for everyone.
And before this episode, I read a news article covering you. And you mentioned that SCB has been working with AI for roughly 4 years. Why did SCB start working with AI?
Why did SCB start working with AI? I can't really put words in other people's mouths, but I think it was time. I think the reason why everybody's talking about AI right now is the fact that we have been aggregating or collecting data for years and years. And now the technology is there, the compute power is there, so that you can start to do more algorithms and more understanding of clients via algorithms. But then it's also about having the right people in the organization and listening to them, so that when people have this kind of good idea, you give them the chance to try. Yeah.
And what was the first thing within AI that SCB worked with?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the first things that the team did, so my team did, was to look into the kind of customer journey to understand our retail clients. When do they connect with us in the branch office? When do they use the internet bank? When do they use the app? And can we somehow predict where we should be doing development, for instance? Yeah.
And why did you start with that?
It was very much because the head of the division was very into it. So he gave us the opportunity to do something. And we could kind of, I mean, and it was very obvious that there would be a lot of value in combining these data sets. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you have a lot of competing potential projects at that stage that you could do instead?
No. No, I mean, it's been kind of a... I think it's been a really interesting implementation. And I mean, I think one of the reasons why it's been quite successful is that it's been both grassroots and top level driven. I mean, we have so many super talented people in the bank that really want to do machine learning, and they really want to use their data to create a better business in their business area. And just finding those individuals and kind of giving them the time to do that, I think that's really a success factor. Because if you try to isolate the data science team and you put them outside the organization, I have a hard time to see that would work.
So your special forces team, as you call it, how has it changed over the years that you have led it in terms of headcounts, but also your focus area?
Yeah, we've grown. 4 years ago, there was two people working in the team from a company called Combient. So Combient is a company that we co-founded together with a lot of other industrial companies, because we realized that we have like a digitization thing in common that we need to figure out. And if we can connect and talk about the common challenges, then probably that's a good thing. Yeah, so in the beginning, there was two. And then we've grown sort of successively. And I think this is probably the level where we might stay for a while, because now it's all about focusing on different areas. And I would say in the beginning, it was very much sort of more data engineer than data scientist. And now it's very much more data scientist focused. So, I mean, natural language processing, for instance, is a capacity that we need. And then I've been fortunate enough to hire like stars in that area. I don't know why, but it's really, really fun.
And how would you differentiate between data engineering and data scientist?
There's a lot of gray zone in between a data engineer and a data scientist, I would say.
There's a lot of buzzwords within AI also when it comes to the role descriptions, right?
Yes, very much so. I mean, data engineer for me is someone who's really good at doing exchange transform load, that's good at maintaining the sort of data science specific compute platforms and that kind of thing. The data scientist is someone who's really good at sort of feature engineering, figuring out what algorithm is the best, testing it for accuracy, testing it for balance in the data and things like that. And then when you want to put the model into production, you need to talk to the data engineer. So you figure out sort of where should we put it. The IT architect can come and sort of point, you should put it here. And then the data engineer and the data scientist kind of figure out how to move the model into production and how to get it to run smoothly.
And what are you looking at when you recruit a new member to the team?
So I hire data scientists, not so much data engineers. That's done by the more IT part of the program.
Okay.
When I hire data scientists, I'm looking for a combination of factors, actually. We have a small job task that you get. So you get to do a small data science project, and then you come and meet us and sort of explain what you've done. And I think that's been really, it's a really good way of doing it, because it's a nice atmosphere. We have a good discussion about what the person has done, and then we can have sort of a discussion about the data and all the sort of detail things. And then we get a good sort of feeling for what level the person is on. And you don't have to be a stellar data scientist to do data science, but you have, there are some sort of personality traits that are more beneficial. And so my colleague, I always have someone who's not a data scientist interview the data scientist, and they can and they have to explain something super technical. And that's been really interesting because that's how we can sort of glean how good they are at communications. And it's the same there. You don't have to be a good communicator, but if you're not, then it's good for us to know that. So then we can sort of give you work where you don't have to be too sort of facing the business side. Because we have so many different things that we need to do. And if you prefer to sit in at your desk and do programming, then that's good for me to know, because then I won't put you in front of people.
And to join the Special Forces team, do you need to have many years of industry experience?
No, you don't. You need to be nice. That's very, very important to me.
You look a lot more on the personal characteristics.
Yeah, I mean, the skills are definitely a hygiene factor. You have to have like either a mathematics background, computer science, computational linguistics is absolutely fine. Anything that has with actual machine learning to do, some sort of background in that. Hopefully education-wise, and if possible, experience-wise as well. But we've recruited a lot of people directly from the universities as well.
But what about the people with econometrics background?
Yeah, we have one. Yeah. That's absolutely fine. Yeah. But then you have to be interested in learning Python, and you have to be interested in learning new things. And if you're interested in learning new things, then yeah, then you're more than welcome. Yeah.
What would your advice be to maybe a student listening to this episode? If they want to come and work for you, what would you say to them? What should they focus on if they have 2 years left of school?
Good question. I would say focus on learning how to do machine learning. Focus on figuring out what kind of data you find most interesting. Figure out what kind of a job you want. How are you as a person? Do you like to present results? Do you like to create results? Do you like to go into the details? Because that's very beneficial for yourself to know, because that's going to also make it easier for yourself to figure out where you want to work. If you like physical robots, then probably SEV is not the right place to come. But if you like to create financial robots, then that might be something really interesting. And I think it's all about just study what you're interested in. Because that's it's 5 years of your life, and it should be enjoyable.
But is it enough to focus hard in school, or should you do things beyond school? Do you think that the education we have right now is good enough?
Ooh, that's a political question.
I could start up with saying I don't think it's good enough.
Yeah, I mean. One of the things that, I keep referring back to the AI agenda, but I mean, one of the things that I think we need in Sweden is a national curriculum for AI, so that when industry participants are hiring data scientists, you don't have to read as closely through the sort of records of what courses they've read. You can actually just assume that they probably know the basics of machine learning. One of the things that we're also talking about quite a lot that I believe could be quite a key success factor is having more industry participants join lectures and join courses and give sort of real life examples of what the issues are when you do machine learning in industry. Because one of the things that I know from kind of my studies is that the data quality is never discussed. You always get perfect data. It's like perfectly parsed, it's perfectly prepared for you, and then you just run with it. But in business, that's very rarely the case. You get some sort of a data and they start figuring out how it works, and you try to talk to the business and they try to explain, and it's like a whole iterative procedure. And that can be kind of quite surprising when you come as a newly graduated person from university.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. A while ago, I looked back at my university lecture notes, and I saw just one slide during my whole education mentioning data and data quality issues.
Yep.
And in practice, I mean, people usually say it takes like 80% of the machine learning time. It's spent on data.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and because it's also, and that's not just data quality. It's also very much getting to know the data and getting to know the business and the implications of the data that you have on the business.
Yeah.
So I think, I keep hearing that like the goal is to take away that sort of part of the project, and I wouldn't really agree.
You mean that people want to automate the data quality and relating data to the business problems and so on?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think part of that can definitely be automated, but part of it is very much sort of getting to know each other and getting to know the data. And we're humans, so we need to get to know each other if we want to work together.
You're kind of a separate function working across the entire organization. That's kind of differing from the other very common way to organize your type of function, to basically put it within a function in an organization, such as the marketing department, the sales department, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the benefits and drawbacks with your way of organizing your function as a separate function across the entire organization?
I think one of the benefits is that we're not really part of the potential politics in the company, because we are separate. And so, and we don't really have our own agenda except doing loads of AI and machine learning. and I think so my team is like, it really is the best team. They're so nice. And the thing is that when a business unit starts to think about applications of AI in their business, it can be a bit scary. It can be a bit like you have to tell someone that you don't really know what it is. And that's not always a very comfortable feeling as a human. And then it's so important that we as data scientists are nice and that we take the time to sort of figure out what kind of questions they could be interested in, how we maybe could be helping them and having a nice collaboration.
But are you sometimes seen as outsiders?
I don't know if we're seen as outsiders, because I think some people who haven't collaborated with us yet might see us a bit as outsiders. I know that somebody once told me that he called me the algorithm gal and that he thinks that I'm like completely from outer space. And that's fine. I mean, it's everybody's entitled to their feelings. But I think as long as our heart is really in it for doing better business and giving better customer service, I think having feelings should be acknowledged and talked about. Yeah,
I can imagine that the situation now differs a lot from when you recently started.
Yeah.
Initially, a lot of people maybe thought that you were there to automate away their function and their jobs.
Yeah.
Did you meet that a lot?
Yeah, it's happened a couple of times at least that people have been like a little bit scared when we come and visit. But I think the proof is kind of in the pudding. If you look at the things that we've done, I can't disclose too much of it because we're a bank. But if you look at the things we've done, I think since it's been close collaborations, we have a lot of sort of friendly people in the bank that like to work with us. And that kind of takes away a lot of the scariness. And I mean, even with we have a separate team that works with automation in the bank. And there it's been really interesting when we try to sort of remove these manual, redundant, really boring tasks of like copy pasting stuff. And the way we've done it is that we have a robotics team that comes and educates the unit in how to do the sort of automation. And then they do it themselves. And they really love it somehow. If you get to upskill yourself and remove boring tasks, then most people like that.
And do you put automation into the definition of AI?
I do not put robotics, like scripting, I don't see as AI.
So when you refer to the automation team, are they mainly working with robotic process automation?
Yes, I would say so, yeah. They're going to kill me now.
But that has been a strong trend like the last 2-3 years, right? A very strong growth in that sector.
Yeah.
How would you describe robotic process automation?
Robotic process automation is very much sort of, it's like advanced macro scripting. It's like advanced VBA.
That we have had for decades in Excel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, but it's all about the integration between different systems, because if you have two systems that cannot communicate with each other, you need to figure out a way that they can. And then the scripting is quite, it's a good way to do that. And I think in the beginning we were sort of scripting a lot of different things, and now the automation is focusing much more on the end-to-end process. Like, do we actually need scripting, or are there ways that we can do things better and faster? Yeah. And I think that's the right way to do it. But I think the only way to start is to do the sort of scripting part.
So you're talking about people going back to the more traditional kind of back-end integration again.
Yeah, yeah. APIs.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. I totally agree. When the robotic process automation kind of hype started, everyone did automation through scripting. I mean, they almost forgot how they did automation before that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's really interesting. And because I remember I heard the word robotics the first time and I was like, yes, we're going to have robots in finance. But that wasn't true.
So I would like to, if it's possible, to move into some concrete projects that you've done. And you mentioned one of your first projects was the customer journey.
Yeah.
And could you just describe what was the business problem being solved there?
Yeah, so the business problem was really understanding what interfaces our clients were using for what. Being able to improve the customer experience in the digital interfaces and being able to identify sort of potential improvements that we could do in the branch offices and in the customer call center.
What type of data did you use for this?
All of the sort of data about how our customers were interacting with us. So for digital, it was kind of what web pages were they in on? What did they click on? Where did they move? And things like that. For the branch offices, it was more like what time did they show up? Yep. And what did they do before coming to the branch office? And what did they do after? And for the call center as well. So just kind of understanding what is it that drives clients to call us? What is it that drives clients to come to the offices? And how can we sort of, do they enjoy that? Or would they rather have a digital interface where we could solve their problems instead?
And you kind of merged all of these data sets,
yeah,
and followed all the different individuals through your entire kind of customer interface.
Yeah, exactly. So we did like a segmentation of digital behavior, I would say. Yeah.
Yeah. And what type of algorithm did you use?
Oh, I don't remember. It was some sort of a clustering algorithm, probably KNN or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And what did you do with that insight?
So that it had quite a lot of different implications. So we use it now for sort of business planning reasons, for planning of development of the digital interfaces. Sort of small tweaking, which I think is really not to be underestimated. I think that's kind of the sweet spot. Hopefully many of the AI implementations that we will see will not really be noticeable. It's just that it gets a little bit better.
Yeah, so this kind of is a very common type of way to start off with AI if you look at other organizations, but it's quite far away from this that you normally think of in terms of, I mean, an algorithm doing automated decisions to the end customers directly, right?
Yeah.
So here you did a clustering of the data, and when you get that result, that's kind of when the real job starts.
Yeah.
To make sense of that and to understand how should you implement it in business.
Yeah, exactly.
How often do you update this clustering model?
So that one I think is updated on a monthly basis or something, because some of the data is delivered in batch. That's always sort of in the sort of data exploration phase, that kind of thing needs to be considered, because some data sets only are delivered once a quarter, or like financial results for companies are typically annual. Sometimes they do quarterly reports that you can use as well. But it is all about getting access to whatever data you can get access to will kind of define how often you can update your model.
Yeah. And who were the recipients on the business side of this project?
Yeah, so it was a lot of different people. It was at the time it was Customer Insights, who worked with like marketing campaigns and things like that, and then our digital banking that works with sort of the customer experience in the digital interfaces. Yes.
And how do you evaluate the success of this kind of a project?
It varies between the projects. It depends on what the goal of a project is. If it's to create efficiencies, then we can measure the increase in efficiency. If it's to create better understanding, then that's more sort of difficult to quantify. So it kind of varies a lot.
Mm. In this case, it was the latter type of project, right?
Yeah.
To create better understanding.
Yeah.
Would you say that this project has been successful?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And kind of based on what?
Based on the attention that it's gotten, and based on the fact that it is actually integrated into a lot of the business planning for the private customer segment. That's for me, that's success when we've been able to create new kinds of insights that drive business decisioning. I think that's sort of, in that case, that's exactly what we were hoping for.
And normally people from the business area, especially if they are kind of new working with AI, they want to get some sense of the return on investment of certain projects.
Yeah.
And in this case, you kind of cannot measure that, right?
No.
What would you say to someone who wants a return on investment measure?
That then we need to choose a different project.
How do you evaluate that the output of your machine learning model in this application was good enough?
Yeah, so I mean, it's kind of a silly case to talk about, maybe, because it's I think the evaluation is usually done together with the business people that asked for a collaboration, and then it's all about getting feedback, trying out different tweaks to see whether that improves the experience, and then seeing whether the model was kind of right or not.
Yeah. Are you doing A/B testing?
No, I'm trying to push for it.
Yeah. Okay, so it's a lot kind of gut feel.
It's been so far. So, I mean, that's why we are becoming more data-driven, so that we can keep our gut feeling, because that's it's a valid thing, and it's based on loads of experience, and sometimes it's really difficult to explain why you have a feeling that something is going to happen. But if you've been working in a place for a long time, or you know your clients really well, then you might actually be right. And then, but then having this sort of data-driven decisioning on the side, it can give you either an insight that maybe you didn't have, or it can just tell you that yes, your gut feeling is valid, and here are kind of the reasons why, and that's of course very empowering.
Is there some other interesting projects that you would like to mention?
We have one model that I believe that we're public about. It's a revenue growth model for small and middle-sized companies. So this is a really successful project, because we did it together with the branch offices in south of Sweden, trying to understand the financial situation of our SME clients. Smaller middle-sized companies, and in the beginning it was kind of like, can you predict fast growing companies, and we said we don't know what that means, but probably. And then it was all about sort of figuring out what data sets they would usually look at, and using their gut feeling and using their experience to combine different data sets and to build sort of a predictive model.
Who are they, their gut feeling?
The client executive is in the branch offices.
What data sets did you end up using?
Loads of internal data, loads of external data. So like the typical financial data that's available for companies in Sweden, to have as much data as possible.
Like annual reports.
Yeah.
Transaction data.
Yeah. Quarterly reports, annual reports, the data that's available from UC, I think it's called.
Yeah.
And then all of the internal data that we have on our clients.
Yeah. And, when you have both internal data and external sources for data, the question of data quality becomes very apparent, right?
Yes.
How do you ensure that the data is of good quality?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So we use the sort of business skills of our, in this case, the client executives in the branch offices, and customer insights at CMPC, who were sort of the project managers and gave us the data and helped us figure out how to do this together. So it was very much that, sort of looking into the data together.
And what type of models did you use for this forecasting?
It's some sort of a gradient booster,
And how did you end up using this? And so the process of choosing between different models, if there was a process.
Oh, yes, there was. I mean, it takes a while to build a model that you feel comfortable with. So the way we did it was that we split it into two parts. So one part is the internal data, where we can get as much information as possible from that data. And the other is the external part. So we did two separate models in the end, because that gave us the best result. And then, I mean, what we try to do is use... when it is something that is sort of in some sense client facing, because we want to be able to understand why a client shows up in the list, then we want to use as simple algorithms as possible, because the sort of explainability of the algorithm is kind of crucial. We want to feel comfortable that the clients that we're pinpointing are relevant.
So no black box algorithms here.
No, I mean, depends on what you think is a black box. If you think a computer is a black box, then everything is black box. Yeah.
But is there a requirement for that from a regulations point of view?
It depends on the purpose of the model. If we're using it, like in this case, it's just for customer relationship management, then the regulations aren't really there. But if we were to use more machine learning models for risk or for some sort of measures that fall under regulations, then yes, absolutely, yes.
So in this case, the requirement to use an explainable model came from your own organization.
Yeah, I mean, people have a lot of integrity and they want to understand why they should contact a client if they should contact a client, because they don't want to, I mean, of course, they have yrkestolthet, it's called in Swedish. Like, they're really skilled at what they do.
Yeah. And how have you evaluated the performance of this project then?
Yeah, for that one, it's easy because you get feedback after a year. It predicts the revenue for a year. So after a year, you know how it went. Yeah. And then you can start to look into the data to see if there are some things that you should be adding or tweaking somehow.
How do you set the threshold of a good enough performance? So you can measure how well it went after a year, but what is good enough?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, we use it sort of, since we use it for relationship management, it's okay if it's kind of off. And of course, when you're trying to predict revenue growth, if the number is 3 and the actual number is 2.9, is that good enough? So that's kind of a discussion that we have with the business. I mean, given that we were asked to find sort of a gut feeling thing, we're trying to evaluate whether the model is successful in actually doing that. Yeah.
And in this case, has it been possible to kind of quantify the effect to measure some kind of return on investment?
No, not really. I mean, and that's the thing. It's like it's a soft skill thing. So it's difficult to measure the success other than from getting feedback from the branch offices.
Yeah. And what have they been doing with this type of prediction of this model?
Yeah,
So
the way they use it is that they contact the clients and ask them if there's something we can do for them. Because clients that are growing very fast typically have quite different needs than a client that is in more sort of a stable, established phase. And if we can contact them and just listen to them and hear how they're doing, then there might be things that we need to help them with.
So you're kind of being able to become a lot more proactive towards these customers.
Yeah, exactly. That's the goal.
Yeah. And both the customer journey project and this forecasting of SME company revenues project, what has been the time from start to deployment in a sense?
I would say about 6 months, maybe. It varies a little bit because, it's all about getting access to the data and doing the data quality and doing the data management. So if it's a data set that somebody already knows and the data quality is there, then it can go really fast.
So it's mainly the data part taking the time in these projects?
Usually, yes. I mean, it depends on what we're trying to do. And I can elaborate a little bit on that. So we have two industrial PhD students at SCV as well, Hanna Hultin and Johan Seilan. Hanna started a year ago. And what she's doing is that she's trying to use reinforcement learning to understand the next second of order books and on the trading floor. So we have a lot of execution algorithms for our clients where we're trying to execute the trade according to the wishes of the client. So it can be sort of speed, it can be minimizing market impact, loads of different things that clients typically ask for. But then in order to improve the execution algorithms, there is the potential to use some sort of reinforcement learning to actually understand where the order book is going to go in the next second and thereby be able to give better prices to our clients. And that's a really difficult problem. But in Sweden, we're really fortunate because we have the Wallenberg AI Autonomous Systems and Software Program, which is a donation of 4 billion Swedish crowns, so like 400 million euros, into creating an AI research community in Sweden during 10 years' time, and sort of keeping Swedish industry still up and running and still sort of top-notch in 10 years' time. And it's pretty cool because there's, like, just to give you a number, in 10 years' time, there will be 300 PhDs in AI and autonomous systems in Sweden. And we're quite a small country, so I think it's really cool.
And that's based on this donation?
Yeah, yeah, it's based on that donation from the Knut and Alice Wallenberg Foundation. So through that, we've been able to have both Hanna, who does the reinforcement learning for the order book, and Yuan, who is looking into anomaly detection in financial transaction data. And the plan there is to use some sort of topological data analysis or geometric data analysis and
going
see.
Going back to your roots.
Yes, yes. So you can just guess who's the advisor from SEB. It's me. Yeah, and it's so much... There's so much going on in the research community that if we don't keep on track of the latest research results, and if we don't collaborate with researchers, I have a hard time seeing that we'll be able to implement true, sustainable, ethical, well thought through, robust AI, which has to be the goal in a bank because we need to keep the trust of our clients.
Is there some other project that you would like to talk about?
Well, I can talk about the topological data analysis projects forever. The thing is that we're working on a lot of different things, but we've always been a very conservative bank. So we've always been sort of a bit hesitant to talk too much about what we do. I like to say that we under-promise and over-deliver, and I'm quite proud of that. I mean, I've been at SEB for 8 years, and I think it's, for me, it's a source of pride.
But, the projects you have mentioned is probably not what the common person would expect a bank to do within AI.
Yeah.
So are you doing, for example, some credit scoring with machine learning?
Not so much. And the reason is that we are quite conservative and we want to feel sure that the day that we start looking into sort of credit scoring, that we feel comfortable with what we're actually doing.
But what do you think is the hurdle then? What needs to happen before they feel comfortable?
I think different things. I mean, one of the things is that the Swedish regulator and us need to together figure out what is okay to do. And that's really important. To have that sort of a good dialogue, which we have, but to have a continued dialogue and to learn together what the possibilities are, what the risks are, how we can sort of what areas we can manage risk better by using machine learning models, and in what areas we still really, really need to focus on the human in the loop.
Cool. And a couple of years ago, SEB was always in the media coverage because you were one of the first banks, at least here in the Nordics, but also leading globally with a chatbot.
Yes.
Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah. So the digital assistant that we have is called Ida, and we have different installations of the system. So we have an external version where clients can ask sort of simple questions but can't log in and do banking. And then we have actually deployed versions of the chatbot internally. And there it's been really successful in sort of removing the boring, repetitive tasks. So we have her for the IT help desk, and there we save about 10% of the time that people would spend sort of unlocking accounts and all the boring stuff. Now Ida can do that for us. And the same goes for HR. So we have an installation for HR where you can get help with your human resources questions via the digital assistant, so you don't have to surf around in the intranet as much. So the internal version has been really successful. The external version we're still working on. So the internal version speaks English, which makes it a lot easier. The external version, we decided to try to do it in Swedish. And then you get into the whole natural language processing, the context of culture, the context of like not just being able to translate directly to another language, because then it's suddenly nonsensical. So then it becomes like a more sort of sensitive or more difficult problem to tackle. So we actually ended up spending a couple of years teaching the assistant how to speak Swedish together with the provider.
Which is the provider?
It's a company called IPsoft.
Yeah. And do you think that the Swedish version will be able to catch up with the English version within like 5 years? Or should you just use English version all over?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to Swedish, to the Swedish language, this is actually a much, I would say, larger question than just what we do at SEB.
Yeah.
I mean, my probably favorite example of trying to enable voice to text and trying to enable context to language training sets is in Denmark, where the government has, in April, they announced that they're spending money to create like a database where they will have voice files and transcribed voice files, so the transcriptions of the voice files, and they will make that available for everyone. So if you're a researcher, if you're a company, if you want to, like, if you're looking for training data, that will be accessible to you. And I think it would be really fun if we in Sweden could have that as well, because for big countries or big languages such as English, that's kind of already done because there is so much training data available because the languages are huge. For a country like Sweden or Finland or Norway or Denmark or like the Nordic countries, we're quite small in population size. So getting like value from your investment in creating a voice assistant in that language, it's difficult maybe for a big company to see that.
I think you bring up some very good points here, and one of them being that, I mean, it's a big challenge to do the same things you can do a lot better in the English language in Swedish, because it's a much smaller language.
Yeah.
And sometimes from the business side, if they want a chatbot in Swedish, because you have Swedish customers and it works in English, therefore it should work in Swedish. I mean, sometimes it's not that simple, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the sort of transfer learning is getting there, but it's still at a research state, I would say.
Yeah, very experimental.
Yeah.
And I can imagine that being a team of 11 people in an organization with 15,000 employees, you kind of get a lot of potential use cases, at least now, when you have been working for a while and people know what you're doing. How do you kind of identify and prioritize between all the potential use cases that you can be working on?
Yeah, so it's a collaboration. So we, depending on what division is asking for help or for a collaboration, we do like a small assessment of like the data quality, the time that the business can spend with us when we're doing the project. And then we do like a sort of a educated guesstimate of how much time we believe that we need to spend to do the first sort of pilot and how easy it will be to put it into production. And then that is presented to a committee. And then we have a discussion about what we're doing right now, what the new idea could give as business value or new insights. And then we prioritize together.
Who sits in this committee?
It's loads of people from the business units.
How big is it?
It's about, I would say, between 15 and 20 people in the committees. So it's kind of trying to cover all the different business segments in the divisions.
Okay, so this committee prioritizes between all the applications you work on?
Yes.
Okay, cool. And what has taken the most time in your AI work to date? Is it kind of getting access to data, to prepare data, to build the models or to deploy or something else?
It varies so much different between different projects. I'm trying to make an average. I would say what usually takes the most time is probably getting access to the data, because we're a bank, so we need to be sure that we're compliant with all the regulations and that we're not combining data sets that we shouldn't be, that we're allowed to, that the value that we're trying to create with the new project is aligned with the values of the bank and of the customers. Yeah.
Could there sometimes be problems where someone don't want to give you access to a data set?
There could be problems with people not wanting to give us access to the data sets, but then it's typically about sort of more fear. Fear of what we're trying to do. And then it's very much about having a discussion about what the aim is. And sometimes it's been that the people from the business really want us to do something, but then they get caught up in some other project. And then we pause what we're doing because there's no sense that we're trying to build something if nobody gives us feedback.
Or data.
Yeah, exactly.
And what has been some of the biggest challenges?
I would say the biggest challenge is still sort of the culture, because working in a data-driven way is quite different from working just with gut feeling. And it takes time to see the value for every single human being in working in a more data-driven way. So I think we're getting there. Definitely. There's a lot more interest. There's a lot more sort of understanding of why the data actually contains a lot of information that we might miss. But I think we still have a bit of a journey left. So my favorite is this, Daniel Kahneman has this book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And there's an example where if I ask you how your holiday was, and you were like on a week-long holiday, you will give me the average of the total experience over the week and the last day. So even if you know, if I ask you like, how was Monday, how was Tuesday, then you'll be able to answer sort of an average of that day. But if I ask you the overall experience, it will be very sort of biased towards the latest thing that happened. Yeah. For me, that's really an illustrative way of explaining why data-drivenness is important, because then we remove sort of the human bias that we have in our memory and try to add much more sort of balanced information.
But for example, the customers, they are human beings with this bias.
Yes.
Do you think that they will be kind of agreeing with the recommendations that come out of these unbiased type of algorithms?
Oh, that's a good question. Maybe not. I mean, the thing is that we're not trying to push people to do things. We're just trying to give them better advice. And then it is up to the human to take the decision.
Maybe they don't agree that it's better, right?
Yeah. And that's they're entitled to their own opinion, and that's more than fine. And people should have opinions, and people should be very sort of attentive to what decisions they're taking.
Yeah. But you have a good point that you can at least not have this heavy bias on the most recent memory.
Yeah.
But then again, maybe the most recent events are more relevant.
Yeah, of course.
More timely.
Yeah.
5 years from now, will you still be in your current role? And if so, how will your team look like? And what will you be doing?
Yeah, that's a big question. I hope that AI and the AI tools will be very integrated into the business. I know that I at some stage said that I hope that I won't be needed anymore, and I still stand for that. I really hope that it's going to be so integrated that my team isn't really needed anymore, that everybody sort of has individuals that they can use in their own business and ideas that they can just implement themselves.
So basically each function having its own data science team.
Yeah, at least the functions where data science is useful. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so what would you be doing then?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, what I'm always driven by what's fun and what's interesting and what's a little bit difficult, so I don't get bored. And I mean, what I'm really passionate about right now is kind of helping the business to use AI toolings and to figure out what data they have and what the value is in it. And then seeing if we have the skills in-house, seeing if it's something that we can just buy off the shelf, or seeing if it is actually something that we need to connect with researchers for. So I hope I'll be doing something a little bit similar.
Yep. Related to that, what's your take on off-the-shelf purchases of AI systems versus developing yourself?
Yeah, I think for some purposes, it's more than fine to just buy it off the shelf, like a digital assistant we wouldn't build ourselves. So for some components and for some models, it's there are really good tools out there. But in the very core of what our bank is, I think it's important that we at least understand exactly what it is we're buying, if we're buying, and that we have a way of benchmarking the tools that we would then look at. And the only way to be able to benchmark it is to have your own resident data scientists that actually know how to build a model. So, yeah, that's what I think.
Yeah, I think this relates back to what we talked about initially about many top management people in other big organizations believing that if you just put enough money in, then you have AI up and running, right?
Yeah.
But if you need to in-house develop things, then it takes time.
Yeah.
And even if you buy things off the shelf.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the big part, the data exploration, the data quality, the data governance, the data management, it doesn't go away by buying a tool. You can't really buy. I mean, there are tools that can accelerate that journey, but it's still going to take time. And if you don't allow that to take time, then I can 95% guarantee that you're not going to do good things.
Yeah, this is one of these areas where if you kind of 10x your input in terms of investments, you don't really get 10x the output.
No, I would say so, yeah.
And when it comes to finding out what you can and cannot do with your data because of GDPR and similar regulations, how do you go about to find out things in this area?
Yeah, so I mean, we have data protection officers in the bank that work within the divisions, and they are experts at data privacy law. So we talk to them a lot, and then we figure out whether we need to kind of anonymize the data or if it's okay to use it just as it is. And then we have loads of lawyers and really skilled compliance officers that we can talk to as well.
Are they all in-house resources?
Yeah.
That's cool to be big enough to have
Yeah. And I mean, as a bank, we've always had sort of committees for new products and model committees and all kinds of committees that have the skills to assess whether we're doing the right things.
Yeah. And one thing that is being talked about quite a lot nowadays is ethical and sustainable AI. What does that mean to you? And do you use that in practice?
Yeah, it means a lot to me. I mean, we have this. So in the same Wallenberg AI Autonomous Systems and Software program, there is now an edition called Humanities, I think, in Social Sciences, so HS. And there we have a professor who's part of the high-level expert group for ethical AI, Virginia Dignam. She's a professor at Umeå University, and she's probably one of the coolest people I know. and she has spent a lot of time thinking about ethics and how to implement ethics into your AI models. So we via Combient have been speaking to her. We have a team that's working on the sort of ethics. Can we have some sort of guidelines or prioritization for being able to assess whether your AI is ethical? But she has a really nice approach where she calls it the glass box approach. So you start with the values that your company has, that your culture has, and that your clients have, so that you know, okay, this is what we want to do. And then you translate it into quantitative values so that you can check that your model is adhering to these values. And there, of course, it's going to depend on what data you're looking at, what the purpose is, what the scope is, what the intent of the whole project is. And then you can integrate that into the modeling so that you feel certain that what you're doing is sort of okay from an ethical perspective. And if you don't if you've never thought about ethics before, I can recommend the high level expert group. They have a checklist for sort of ethical AI. It's very vast, but of course there are sort of you need to tweak it so that it fits your business purpose, because like ethics for a robot is different from ethics in a digital interface. But it's really useful to use something like that. So you have sort of a checklist that you can check whether your AI is ethical. But that in no way should remove the more human discussion as well, because it becomes quite sort of philosophical.
Yeah. And when you talked about this kind of quantifying different ethical aspects, do you think that everything is quantifiable?
No. I mean, I think everything is quantifiable in some sense. But I also think that it's really important to keep the human in the loop, as they say in the high-level expert group. And I completely agree with that. And I think that's sort of going to be the make or break of AI, keeping the human aware of what the model is doing, keeping the human understanding and monitoring and tweaking so that it stays on top of the ethical questions.
Yeah, and one very popular stream within this ethical and sustainable AI area is the model interpretability or explainability.
Yeah.
And sometimes you hear people discuss that there is this trade-off between interpretability and kind of performance of the algorithms. What's your take on that?
Yeah. I mean, if you build a super advanced deep neural net, then it's going to be really difficult probably to explain what it's doing. So I would not use that for a lot of banking applications. And I think the kind of trade-off depends on what you're trying to do. But I think you always need to understand what your model is doing. And one of the sort of focus areas within the Wallenberg AI program is explainability. And there are sort of methods of taking a super advanced algorithm and creating a decision tree out of it. So if you really need like 100% explainability, that's probably the best way to go. But then if you want to have some sort of a understanding of the robustness of the algorithm, there are ways of trying that as well.
So you're basically referring to the fact that you take a very complex algorithm and then you proxy it with a simpler, more explainable model, right?
Yeah.
But looking at the research within that area, these methods are not always so robust.
No, I agree.
I would say it's very much on an experimental stage.
Yeah. And I mean, the whole sort of explainability of models is very complicated.
So what would you say are the main purposes of having an explainable model?
Being able to explain when it's client-facing, being able to explain to the client why we took a decision that we took or why we're recommending what we're recommending, and feeling comfortable that that is actually the reason for it and that it's aligned with our values and the values of the client.
So kind of creating trust in the system.
Yeah. I mean, the person using the model needs to understand what it's doing, and the person being impacted by the model needs to understand what it's doing. So it's very much up to transparency and explainability.
Do you think it's usable for kind of debugging of code?
Oh, yes. Yes, I've seen so many cool articles about that. Definitely. Yes.
In what aspect?
I've seen sort of... I've seen models that generate code so that you don't have to write the code yourself. And I know that there's a lot of talk about AI ops. So like being able to look into the logs of computer systems, being able to look into the loads of computer systems, and being able to do much more sort of predictive maintenance for IT systems. Yeah.
Cool. And... given your experience kicking off the AI work at such a big organization like SCB, what would be your kind of top three advice for someone from a top management team in another organization listening to this podcast? Mm-hmm. What would your advice be if they are thinking about, I want to start working with AI in my organization?
Yeah, I would say educate yourself on the possibilities with AI. Have a very reasonable expectation on what the implications will be. Don't expect it to be too big too fast, because it needs to start small and then allow it to scale. So start with a small project, start to understand how that can impact your business, and then start adding things to it. So, I mean, one of the empowering things about this kind of tooling is that it's all about the data. So you can suddenly have very different business units collaborating. And that is such a brilliant thing when that happens. So you can have people from completely different business areas suddenly figuring out, oh, we have a lot in common, let's collaborate. And that creates it creates a lot of employee engagement if you do it in the right way. if the expectations are reasonable, if you start small, and if you allow your employees to do it to themselves as much as possible.
Yeah. And now to the final question of this episode. Who are two guests that you would like me to invite to this podcast and why?
So I have a lot of people that I would like to nominate, but I would definitely recommend Danica Krajic. If she isn't already on your list, I suspect she might be. She's a professor in robotics perception and learning, and I admire her for many different reasons. I think she's a obviously super skilled researcher, but she's also, as a leader, I think she's, for me, she's really an inspiring person.
Cool. I actually know her.
Oh, good.
and I like her a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I think she's the perfect combination of talent and human.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the second one is Shiva Sandartavalai. She's in ABB and she builds real robots. And I think it's the same there. Every time I see her, I'm a little bit more happy than I was before. And she's super, super skilled and she's so nice. And it's also, it's another person that's really, yeah, someone that I admire and I love to hang out with.
Cool. I've actually already tried to invite her to the podcast, but she has been a bit too busy for now.
Don't give up.
Yeah. After this nice recommendation, she will probably say yes.
I hope so.
Yeah. Thank you very much for joining the Talk About AI podcast.
Thanks. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Talk About AI podcast. If you have any feedback on how the podcast can be improved or suggestions for future speakers, please don't hesitate to reach out. The contact information can be found on talkaboutai.com. Tune in again in exactly 1 week for the next episode. Until then, have a nice time.